exploring the importance of having the right skills to succeed. This is Skillfully Speaking, supported by Babcock International. In this special compilation presented by Skills Ambassador Jackie Grupp, we focus on the importance of being authentic, mental health and resilience, and building a business. Let's start with authenticity. We'll hear from Theatre Royal Plymouth CEO James Mackenzie Blackman, Dame Kelly Holmes, and young entrepreneur Ben Towers. But first, in a world dominated by social media, it's sometimes hard to separate the fact from fiction. Let's hear what Liz Earle had to say.
There was always, in the past, a focus on qualifications, but actually there is a lot of discussion around that softer skills, like communication, like resilience. You mentioned team building. So how did you adapt your communication skills to convey a real complex health concept across various media platforms?
I think the starting point for everything, whether it's a career in corporate world or career as an entrepreneur, is authenticity. You know, you have to be truly authentic. And I think what social media has taught us is that transparency is really important, because we can't hide anymore as brands. And in the old days, I remember when I started the beauty company with my friend Kim, you know, if somebody had a complaint, for example, they would write us a letter and they would stick a stamp on the envelope and they'd post it and we'd get it, you know, a week later, and we'd think about the reply and then we'd write back, and, you know, time would go by and you had that kind of thinking time. Now, you know, if somebody is messaging you about something that they're disgruntled with on Twitter or X, as we now need to call replied within like 20 minutes, it's, well, why aren't you replying to me? What have you got to hide? So I think one of the things that I've had to learn and encourage my team, my publishing team, is speed, speed of response, but also accuracy and being authentic, not trying to hide things. We obviously all try and do our best. We try and get things right all of the time and check and double check, but we're not infallible. Things will go wrong. And I think it's really important to be able to hold your hand up and say, actually, do you know what? Thanks for calling that out, because that was an error. And we're really glad that you've picked that up and you spotted it, because now we can do what we need to do to change it. So I think one of the challenges is to always be authentic, always to be transparent, because that puts you in really good stead. You can't argue with the truth, can you?
No.
And I think people realize that when you are doing your best, that's something to be respected, and you're not trying to obfuscate and hide, which is great for small brands who are nimble. I think for the bigger brands who do run their organizations by committee, that's really hard, because very often, you know, you'll get a problem and it's got to be escalated up to the higher levels before you can reach a resolution. And that takes time. And as time goes by, you know, things can blow up really quickly on social media. I think that's been one of the big learnings for me in recent years, is just how our response time needs to be faster. But at the same time, you can't have a knee-jerk reaction. You have to think about things. You have to have a measured response and consider what the best way ahead is, and not just fire off something blindly without considering the consequences. So it is quite complex.
There are lots of young people looking at you, Ben, and contemplating, thinking, gosh, I want to be just like that. And I know that you've touched on it a little bit already, but what would you say to those people?
I would say two things. One is, I would never, ever, and I used to do this, but now I have to make sure I don't, never ever look at someone and say, I want to be like them. I think that's such a bad mindset. And people do it all the time. And I think it's such a bad mindset to have. And I used to do people like Richard Branson. I would love to be like him. But in reality, no, on reflection, I love the success that he's had and the influence he's had on society and the business that he's built. And that's the part I love. I'm not saying I want to be him. I think you have to get yourself in that mindset to go, but you are you. You're really unique. Everyone's unique. Everyone's got their skills and their blend of who they are, which is unique to you. So use that and don't try and be someone else. Be you, and be, but maybe you can get inspiration from other people. I think that for me is like one key element of that. The other big thing I would say is just go out and actually do it and give it a go. And entrepreneurial skills, I want to really highlight, is you don't have to be an entrepreneur to be entrepreneurial. You can work at a company and to be entrepreneurial. For me, if I were to define an entrepreneur, it's a problem comes, I get to that problem, and do I look at that problem and go, oh, not possible, and go backwards? Or do I look at that problem and go, how do I get around it to then carry on? That for me is entrepreneurial thinking, and that can be applied to work in a big bank, it can be applied if you're running your own company.
I brought out a book because in June 2022, I did a documentary called Kelly Holmes Being Me. And that documentary was me talking about being a gay woman, which I hadn't talked about at all in my public life, because I had lived through an era and a fear of coming out publicly as gay, because when I was in the military, it was against the law to be gay, basically. And when I joined the military, I didn't know I was gay. It just happened that, you know, I was. And what happened was, is that over my life and journeys, being in the military, being an elite athlete, there was a lot of barriers to being my authentic self. Firstly, being in an industry or situation with the military where it was illegal, I lived with that fear of being found out because I didn't want to lose my career and I didn't want to be kicked out and I didn't want, you know, all the things that went with the potential of that. And then back in the day, again, diversity and inclusion wasn't talked about like it is now at all. I didn't know anyone in sport. We talk about role models who was gay. So there was no role modeling for me. I didn't know at all. So at the age that I finished my athletics career, which was actually 35 when I retired my athletics career, I still kind of kept that in. Because now I was put on a pedestal in the country. I became a household name and I was worried about the bigotry and the bullying and the judgment that went on in society back then. So I kept it in. And basically what happened is lockdown came and I got to a point where I just thought, I can't deal with just not being myself, because diversity and inclusion has become such a massive part of what society is about now, giving people the right to be them, to live their authentic life, to just bring their full sense of themselves to their work or to college or university or whoever, because that's what gets the best out of people, because they're happy. Whereas I didn't have that. So I went through two careers where I was being me and I was being the best I could be at it, but there's something inside that wasn't allowing me to feel happy. So I had the lockdown, and during lockdown, I basically lost the ball. You know, I made a decision that I have a choice to live or to not live. It got to that point. And to live was to be okay being in the public domain saying I'm a gay woman. But that took me 34 years of living in fear to do that. And I'm cutting this story really quick. I'm really skirting over the story, really. But the fact is, I brought the book out really just to describe what that journey was like during lockdown, because I'd already brought out an autobiography in 2005, which was talking about my life, my upbringing, my career, my successes, my everything. But it didn't really have me. So this story is really about my journey to being my authentic self. It tells a real in-depth pathway of my mental health and how that deteriorated throughout all of the years. One, because when I put so much into being the athlete I wanted to be, was also because I felt that that was given me. Because I couldn't give the other part of me. Being successful athlete was driving me to be happy because, you know, I could win medals, but then that's not yourself, is it?
You know?
So anyway, I bought out this book called Unique. And the reason why I called it Unique is when I was at school and I was the only mixed race girl or person of colour in school, I was like the only white kid in everywhere I went. And I remember back in the day, there was, some people might not know this song, but there was a song called Brown Girl in the Ring by Boney M.
Yeah.
And of course, I was the brown girl in the ring. And instead of making that a detriment to me when I was pushed in the middle, I was like, oh, tra-la-la-la-la, singing the, you know, middle of the ring, thinking, oh, well, I don't want to be the same as everyone else. And when I went to secondary school and I felt I was useless at everything because I was not academic, and then I found the one thing that I was good at, which was running, and again, I felt really different. I remember turning around to my friends and saying, I don't want to be the same as everyone else, so I'm unique, so I'm going to have that. And that was taking that positive edge to what could have been a real negative childhood of feeling, who am I? What am I doing? You know, I'm so not me. And I took that name, and that's why I called it Unique.
Yeah.
And it was just the fact of holding on to something that made me who I was. So when I couldn't be my true, authentic self, I had that one thing that I just thought, well, I'm not the same as anyone else. Anyway, to give this more context and to cut it down for you, I did a book called Unique, and I did it because I wanted people to know that it's okay to be you, and everyone has the right to be them, to live their life authentically, to be heard, to be seen. Because at the end of the day, we have to live through our life as well. We have the right to stand side by side with everybody else, because what makes us us is our differences. Everybody is different for a reason. And if you can't bring your difference, then you're never being your true, authentic self. And you can never really gain everything you want to gain from who you are, because you're hiding a part of you. And I think the moment that people can be that and stop hiding the part of them, that's when anyone looking at you gets you. Now I can be open. I go for meals with people. I'm getting to learn about people. I'm asking questions. I'm meeting so many people. I've made so many friends. Up until June 22, I didn't do that. Yeah, I'm double Olympic champion Dame Kelly Owens. People can't understand the difference. And the difference is me being me. So I'm really happy with who I am now. I shout about the need to have diversity and inclusion in the workplace and in society. I think it's important people understand the need for people to have their individualism. I think the difference between not and being is a life decision. It's very detrimental to people who can't just feel they can breathe because they're worried about how you think about them, how they look, what they're saying, what they're doing. And if half your life is consumed with those negative thoughts about what people think about you, you're only living half of your life. And that's what I felt I was doing as a person. So now I'm an advocate for diversity and inclusion. And I'm never going to go, as I say in the book, behind the curtain again. I'm going to be my true, authentic self. And I also realise that if anyone judges me after now saying I'm a gay woman, yet they cheered me on across the track or inspired my being as a person, it's your problem, not mine.
You got a purpose message when you are speaking and public speaking.
I don't think that I have a specific message that I always try to communicate in all these different situations where I am speaking. What I do spend a lot of time doing when I'm preparing to speak in front of a large group of people is I try to spend an equal amount of time thinking about who my audience is going to be as I do about thinking about what I'm going to say. And I think that that is really important.
Yeah.
Because if you're really reflective about who's in the room, that then shapes not just what you're going to say, but the way you will say it, the level of formality that you might bring. That's perhaps the most important thing that I do. I think as much about who's in the room as I do about the words that are going to come out of my mouth, really, and the way in which I need to communicate and how much humour I can bring and how relaxed I can be or how formal I can be. You know, we've been in rooms together where
I've spoken
or I've heard you speak or you've heard me speak. But I also try to not hide my personality.
Yeah.
I just think that if you're able to let your personality lead, then that's always going to be enough.
Many of us will experience mental and physical health problems during our lives. It's okay to admit you're not okay. We'll hear more from Dame Kelly Holmes, Liz Earle, Ben Towers, as well as TV presenter and life coach Anna Williamson. But first, here's former MP Robert Halfon talking about the health challenges he's faced and overcome.
I think we all have, including myself, a civic responsibility for equity and developing people to their full potential, whatever their background or whatever their lives are. And your advocacy for social justice is integral to your political career. But how do you see skills development as a means to bridge social inequalities and create a more inclusive society?
I keep mentioning the ladder of opportunity, and I've already brought it up a few times and answered your questions. It's not just a three-word soundbite. Every rung of the ladder has real policy to it. And of course, every ladder has two pillars. On one side, it's strengthening FE and HE. And on the other, it is social justice and opportunities. I was born with a walking disability myself. Originally, I was told I would never be able to walk. And here I am talking to you as a MP and a minister, thanks to Great Ormond Street Hospital. And other great doctors, but I'm determined to ensure that more apprentices who have disabilities or other special educational needs also take up apprenticeships. So we've started a mentoring scheme. It's in pilot phase at the moment to try and ensure that we give the support and encouragement to apprentices who have those kind of difficulties in life. There's a lot of money that goes to employers if they have a apprentice with a disability, if they need that money. There is money that goes to providers as well. And I'm absolutely determined to support that. And separately, of course, there's the money that goes to FE colleges, the bursary fund, about £160 million. And that is really important as well to ensure that disadvantaged students can benefit from an FE education. We've also trying to ensure that disadvantaged apprentices benefit to do degree apprenticeships. So we've increased the money for that to £40 million from £8 million to £40 million over the next couple of years. But it isn't just about money. It's got to be about culture change and evangelizing about apprenticeships and ensuring that employers absolutely understand and welcome apprenticeships from all backgrounds, because we know that those apprenticeships, all the stats show, are very successful, are very loyal to the companies that have trained them, and usually stay rather than doing their training and go off somewhere else. So it's absolutely no brainer. It's good for the apprentice and it's good for the business as well.
Mental health is an issue, and without our health, to be able to perform, to be able to achieve, to be able to be successful is really, really important. So how do you keep yourself healthy? And have you any views on how we can all keep ourselves healthy in this landscape?
Yeah, so I think mental health, and I'm also Minister for Higher Education as well as Minister for Skills, and I have to say that it's been one of the biggest issues in my higher education inbox, mental health. And it's a huge, huge problem for many, many young people. And there are all kinds of reasons for this. I do think, look, I'm very modern. I love mobile tech and social media, but I definitely think that social media has been part of it. I remember being with some students who almost had like really anxious and anguished because they told me they couldn't get themselves off TikTok and things like that. Literally looking me in the face as if really anguished, and they were on it all night and so on. And I know social media can be a force for good as well, but I do think it has enormous problems. The other point that you mentioned was really, you used the word resilience. I think we need to use that word more. I think we need to do as much as possible to help people with resilience. I remember going to this great college in Newham, Newham Sixth Form College, which has a more academic additional bent to the student, but they teach the students resilience. They have American baseball players come in to talk to the students. It was incredible. They do a kind of exam room type scenario so that students don't get frightened when they have to do exams. Here's a confession, which I know won't be too public, but I was terrible at exams as a child. I was mega stressed. I didn't enjoy them at all. I only got over it by the time I did my master's degree at university. But up until then, even my undergraduate degree, I was absolutely nervous and anxious, didn't sleep the night before, drinking too much coffee, you name it. So I recognize I've learned over the years to deal with it. I think health is really important. Exercise, swimming, although I have problems with my legs, I try to do a lot of swimming, makes a massive difference. And also, I've sort of been on a diet for the last 2 years. I've lost about 3 stone overall. But it goes up and down like a yo-yo, of course. But I think health, exercise, and being in the fresh air.
Yeah.
There's an amazing book that's come out by a journalist called Isabel Hardman, and she calls it The Natural Health Service. And it talks all about the outdoors and how the benefits that that can bring to people's well-being and resilience. And I strongly believe in that. I think if you are in the outdoors, it makes a massive, massive difference.
In today's society, it's about developing well-rounded individuals, and mental health, resilience, and all those softer skills are so, so important.
I didn't get given those gifts of being able to be resilient and have a good self-esteem, not to be confused with arrogance, you know, but high self-esteem is important, and self-confidence. But I had to learn them, you know, and like everybody. And I think this is where it's so important with education, that it is well-rounded, and it pleases me so much now. That wasn't taught when I was at school. You know, nobody had a well-being class. I mean, I think you had a PSHE, but it did certainly didn't cover anything around mental and emotional well-being. You know, you did PE, but begrudgingly, you know, it wasn't a thing. It wasn't talked about. I don't think anyone ever mentioned the word mental health when I was at school, just because it just wasn't on the radar, right? And there lies really the foundation of the problem that I then faced in my mid-20s, because the reason why I am who I am now is because in my 20s, I suffered the most horrendous emotional breakdown. The wheels came off. And really what that means is I suffered with poor mental health because I wasn't looking after myself. I wasn't taking care of my mental and emotional well-being. I'd found myself in a situation in a toxic relationship where it wasn't a healthy relationship at all. I was people-pleasing, so I was saying yes to everybody else. You know, and that typically comes from a place of low self-esteem and low self-confidence. You know, we can perhaps act out and be this confident person on the surface, but inside, if we are really sensitive, I'm a really sensitive person, and I've learned to reframe my sensitivity sometimes, in that sometimes things just aren't personal, you know, and if they are, then they are, you know, and it's about then regrouping myself and surrounding myself with the people that really know me and really care about me. And that can be quite tricky when you have a job in the public eye and everyone does have an opinion, and sometimes it's not always a positive one for whatever reason, and that can be quite hard to swallow. But I basically was unraveling, and what I hadn't realized at the time, that I was suffering with terrible panic attacks, a lot of symptoms that play into poor mental health, such as not being able to eat properly, worrying all the time, excessive worry. And then it got to a point where I always liken it to the car petrol tank was depleting and I wasn't filling it back up again. Filling it up being saying no to things, looking after myself, taking a pause, eating good food, saying no to doing too many things, standing up for myself at work, being my own advocate. And that petrol tank got less and less and less, to the fact it was on beeping. And I can't recognize the signs to say pause, stop. And the signs being I wasn't feeling good. You know, I wasn't enjoying every day. I was waking up dreading the day ahead. I was panicking and stressing and anxious over the smallest decisions. And if I'd recognized that that wasn't me functioning at my normal best level, then I would have done something about it. But nobody taught me about it at school. Nobody teaches anyone, but did in the time. So what happened is I ended up flatlining. That petrol tank ran out. I had the most enormous panic attack. I had terrible insomnia. And at the time, I was presenting a kids' TV show on ITV called Toonatic. And, you know, I'd be like a swan. I was peddling underneath. And in the end, I had to be signed off work for several weeks while I went to see a doctor, a psychiatrist, to really put my mental health in the spotlight. And for me, it was the most cathartic experience. Like, there's quite a lot of controversy around labels. Some love them, some don't. And I think it's really personal whether that works for you or not. For me, walking into a doctor and him saying, you have generalized anxiety disorder, GAD, and panic disorder, was really cathartic, because I was like, this is a thing. Like, I'm not just going mad, because that's how I felt. And he said, no. And here's the reasons why. You know, when you then break down that, yeah, gosh, yeah, I've just been neglecting myself mentally and physically. No wonder, you know, your body and your brain can't survive if you don't look after it. And for me, that was the turning point. And I had some amazing counseling and therapy with him. I had some short-term medication at the time just to get me back on track, because you can't really do the self-work unless you've had some good sleep. Mm-hmm. And then I've been well supported ever since. And then it became such an interest and a passion of mine. And you'll often find a lot of counselors and psychotherapists have personal experience of, you know, their own experience. I wanted to study it and train in it and learn about it for my own reasons, that then in hand turned into another career, which I've been enjoying since 2009 in hand with my TV and broadcasting work. But essentially, I learned through therapy and talking therapy and the power of talking, which we all know about now, which is great. This is why I became a mental health campaigner for Mind 10 years ago, because nobody was talking about mental health and it was shrouded in stigma. It was like, oh, how embarrassing, she's talking about that. Is she unstable? Yeah. No, I'm not.
Yeah.
I'm really proud to hopefully fly the flag that saying having a mental health condition or just having blitz, we all have mental health, as we know, and it's a pretty complex being, our brain, you know, anything can derail us, then it doesn't have to be a terrible thing. And in fact, for me, it actually made my life better, because I learned to listen to myself, put myself first, be unapologetically selfish when it comes to self-care. And then here you go. Here I am.
If you had to give three pieces of advice in terms of if you fail or if you make mistakes, and to get back up again and try again and be determined to keep going, to follow your dreams, what would they be?
Great question. I sort of really have one main one is, first of all, failure is important. Okay. In fact, in NLP world, there's no such thing as failure, only feedback.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And this, I think, is one of the best. It's got a presupposition of NLP and neurolinguistic programming. There is no failure, only feedback. And really hold on to that, because you look at people like Simon Cowell, Richard Branson, Lord Sugar, they all have spoken so openly and written books about the number of times they have failed hand over fist. You know, I have very, very wealthy entrepreneur friends who have literally flatlined and lost everything and then started again. And I think it's really important. Really, my main one is you can always learn something from an experience. Failure is quite a strong word. Yeah. Maybe just haven't succeeded this time, okay, or this project. What have I learned about that situation? What have I learned about myself? And what would I do differently next time? So that's kind of three things there packaged around that.
Beautiful.
And that just helps to springboard you back in the right direction. It's also really important to acknowledge and accept when something hasn't gone right. Sit in that moment. Be a bit naffed off if you are. That's okay. That's important. It's part of the grieving loss process to kind of go, oh, I'm a bit fed up today. And sometimes I do think there's a double-edged sword. We can get a bit fed up nowadays. We go, oh, look positively, look on the bright side. Now, I'm a huge advocate of that. But equally, it is important to not just kick the can of annoyance, frustration, pain, grief, loss down the road. It is important to acknowledge those moments that haven't worked out for you and haven't gone well, and give yourself a limit of time over how long you will allow yourself to sit in that emotion, but then tell yourself at this time, tomorrow, next week, brushed off, done, what am I going to do differently next? And that is how we then pivot ourselves back. What are the learnings? What am I going to do differently?
We live in a world where it's really unfortunate how unsafe things have become to a certain point. I mean, you have to be really mindful of that. From an online perspective, there are so much fraudulent things going on online and crazy activities and things like that. I'm forever seeing on social media these like get rich quick, become a coach, come and do this, post these videos on driving these cars, and I'm going to help you get to six-figure customers doing these five things. And that's like the fraudulent safe is about, I would just keep clear of all of that and focus on, you want to start a company, what is it you want to do, and do that. Don't get lost into this online world, which in reality is full of sharks and full of people who are going to just try and take your money and give you nothing in return. So that's that. Other key thing is, thing about when you're running a business or even just in life, is everyone's got intentions and everyone's got normally a different intention to what you have coming to any conversation. So the other thing that I'm always really cautious of is, why does that person want to meet me? What's in it for them? And what value are you both going to bring? And if you're not fully sure, ask them. And I'll say, sure, I'm happy to meet you for coffee, but what do you want to discuss? And if the answer's a bit vague, I often go, look, I'm not interested in meeting, partly because I want to preserve my time, but also partly from a safety point of view, you don't know what they're thinking or their intentions or anything. So I've always had that from a really young age, and that has enabled me. My mum and dad gave me so much trust at a young age to travel. I mean, I'm really fortunate to speak at a lot of events around the world, and I've been to like Colombia on my own, what could be quite an unsafe place, and doing a talk and things like that. And that's only come because over time they saw that my mindset has always been, you need to protect you. If you don't protect you, then what is the company? When you start a company, it's all about, you know, you are the one kickstarting it. But when you have no team, it's you. So that's that big thing. What I do to protect myself from a well-being point of view is, I love meditation, but I can't put on my headphones and just put on a guided thing and just listen. My brain's always active. I'm always thinking of things. So what I actually do is, there's a form of meditation called a float tank. And basically, it's like a salt bath, and it's like a double bed in size. And you close on the lid and it's pitch black and you float. And I just had to realize that for me, that was my way of just thinking. My brain's popping when I'm in there thinking of it. So I haven't sent this email, I haven't done that. But then I come out after the hour and I just feel like I've just processed all of my thoughts and got through it. And so I'm not saying that's right for everyone. But what I'm trying to say is, you need to find the thing that is for you. The other thing for me is that I play a lot of table tennis. My dad's actually a coach. So for me, I find that it's a way where you put your phone to one side and you're just in the moment. I find the bounce of the ball quite therapeutic. But also those two things, I'd say, have been what's kept me almost focused and helped me have that time to relax. I would say, no matter what you do, even if it's not anything in business, no matter what you do, find the thing that is your hobby that just helps you to relax.
A passion to developing people to their full potential. But what actually is your advice to all those people out there to really start looking after their own health and well-being?
Oh, absolutely. Great question. And it is really important. And I often talk to groups of young entrepreneurs or business people and must a question, what is the greatest business asset that you can have? Thinking that someone's going to say, oh, you know, an MBA or deep pockets to fund your venture or whatever it is. And it is actually your health. And one of the things you need to prioritize above all else is sleep. It's great because it's free. Younger people tend to be not so good at it. But the more we know about sleep, the more we understand how it impacts our brain and our mental health, how it controls our gut health. A lot of our good, beneficial gut bacteria will only proliferate when the body is completely at rest, i.e. asleep. And we used to think that sleep was quite a passive activity. We just flop into bed and that was it and wake up and get on with the real world. Actually, our body does a huge amount of work while we're asleep, but particularly in the brain. So think about from an office analogy, from a business perspective, what happens when we sleep in the brain is it's the time when the brain does its filing. So it gets all the files and all the mess and all the rubbish of the day, and it puts them into little piles and it sorts them out and it stores away our long-term memories, our short-term memories. It's problem solving. It's equipping us with the ability to feel calm and intuitive about what we need to do for the day ahead. So it really is absolutely fundamental. And one of the things I do with my own team at work is I'll check in and I'll say, how did you sleep? What's going on in your life at the moment? Have you got things on your mind? Have you got things that are preventing you from sleep? And having a good sleep hygiene routine is really, really important. So get rid of all the distractions that will prevent you from sleeping well. Obviously, no late night cups of coffee, dark chocolate, drinks, anything that got a lot of caffeine in it. You can use supplements like magnesium glycinate is very helpful for relaxation and rest, making sure that your space is as soundproof as it can be. I know not always easy, particularly if you're at uni, for example, if you're in halls. Earplugs, really good invention. Blackout blinds, you can put up a cheap blackout blind in your room, or you can wear an eye mask. Things that will really help. Even if you think you sleep well, you might want to download a sleep tracking app. I use one called Sleep Cycle. It's just a free app on my phone and it doesn't use Wi-Fi or anything, so I can disconnect it at night. So I haven't got any worries about EMF disrupting my sleep pattern. That's another conversation. But it will monitor how deeply you sleep. And what we want to do is try and aim for a lot of REM, REM sleep, deepest form of sleep. And that's when our brain is really revitalized. So if you're super stressed and you're thinking, I need to get this done, I need to stay up late because it's a problem that I need to solve or a dissertation I need to finish or whatever it is, actually, no, your brain will function much better if it's rested and then you can get on with it during waking hours. And actually, I know this is not something that young people want to hear. And actually, I find it really hard too, even though I'm 60, is try and get up as early as you can. There's so much evidence to show that setting our circadian rhythm by getting up and getting outside,
yeah,
not just getting up, looking at the outside through a window, actually getting those early UV and near-infrared rays from the sun into our retina, no glasses, no contact lenses, straight into the eyes early morning. Obviously, don't stare directly at bright sun, but getting into that environment really helps set up the circadian rhythm. It controls hormone regulation, it controls mood, and it actually helps you sleep better the following night. So if you can get up early, not easy, I know.
If you were talking to your younger self and those feelings and those emotions and that drive and determination, can you remember what age that was and how you felt? And if you were talking to other people, what would you be saying to them right now?
I think it was that sometimes when you do something, you have this either natural ability to feel good about it. It's like, wow, I can do it. It's exciting. And in other things that you try, you have that anxiousness about it and you feel like it's very easy to put a negative on things that you feel like you just cannot do straight away without actually learning about it a bit more and doing a bit more work to get better. Whereas when I ran, I just felt free, you know, and it made me feel good. I remember being at school and not being that academic at all. So going to school was almost like, do I have to do this? But I had really good friends. So my drive to go to school was to meet my mates and have a laugh, to be honest. And then I got into running because that was the main thing I was good at. And I remember my PE teacher telling me, oh, you know, if you concentrate on this, you can be really good at it. Now, back then, there wasn't any focus on it being a career. It was more about, I could be good on this and this makes me feel good. And I remember running a cross country race and I hated it.
I absolutely hated it. I mean, who likes cross country?
It's like,
bad. Freezing. My brain wet. Cold, no. But I came second and I had this little like in my belly thinking, oh, I hate losing. So that was enough fire to then think, oh, actually, I want to get better. So I was in my head good enough to be there, in my head good enough to win a medal. I just didn't have that extra thing about I'm going to be Olympic champion. I won the 800 metres, which if anyone watches it, was like by the skin of my teeth. I always say it like a win's a win, you know, take the wins when you're there. Then I went into the 1500 metres. And in that one, I didn't go in thinking I'm going to be Olympic champion. I went in knowing that I've put all the work in I possibly could. I was injury free for the first year in seven. I had got the best team around me. I'd learned how to race over all those years. All my skills were literally ticked off. Everything like I ever could be as an athlete were ticked off.
Wow.
And so all it was about me staying focused, doing what I'd done multiple times of running around the track, not being overwhelmed by the exterior voices and the track and knowing that it's just another track. I've just got to run the same as I've done every single day to get to this point and not let anything faze me. And it all just went clockwork. It was just the weirdest moment in my life. And I won, obviously, my second gold medal. I wanted to prove to myself that I could be good at something when other people thought I couldn't.
Yeah.
Like that was one of the things. The second thing is I realised I had a talent in something. And I think it's so important that people do see you've got a talent. Everyone's got a talent. Everyone has a talent in something. You just have to maybe find it and try new things and try different things and not let people put you off.
Building a business of any size can be a challenging but rewarding experience. Jackie spoke to AI educator Dan Fitzpatrick, Dame Kelly Holmes, and Liz Earle. But first, here's Ben Towers giving his top tips for building a business and becoming your own boss.
What would be your advice at the age of 11 to the, say, 16 to begin with?
My best piece of advice would be just do it.
Yeah.
And the reason why I say that is because I've had amazing opportunities to meet those other young people my age and chat to people about I want to start a company. And often the first thing they go is, I want to start a company, but I don't know what. And I'm like, doesn't matter. Just find something and learn, do it. If it's car washing, I don't care what it is, but just start it and get it going because you're going to learn so much. I'm not going to say it's a regret because, you know, I did start really young. But one of the things I look back on is I go, you know what? Could I have started younger? Could I have done more? And I think it's more just this idea about just the learning part is the main part. If you start a company at a young age to go, it's going to become the next Google. Yes, that's a good motivation. It's a good focus to have. But you also need to realize that you're going to learn. If you start thinking you are the next Richard Branson right now, then the company won't work. You need to come at it to go, I want to get there, but I'm going to learn along the way. And I think that's almost the skill of entrepreneurship is to be able to hit problems, overcome them, and then keep going.
We are all leaders in life. We use leadership skills with our children. We use leadership skills with our staff. You know, we do with our students. So can you talk to us a bit about the leadership skills that have been essential for you in championing the causes such as Live Twice and supporting health-related charities?
You have to lead by example. There isn't any other option, really. That's kind of bottom line if you want to cut to the chase. And I guess that comes back to authenticity and trust.
Yeah.
Particularly, I guess, for founder-led brands where there is a name attached. For me, you know, Lizelle, for example, is attached to beauty products, although I'm not connected to that anymore. It's attached to publishing and podcasts and fair trade jewelry and all sorts of different things. So there's a real person. So there is somebody to actually watch. But even within organizations, you know, a university will have a head, will have a chancellor, a company will have a CEO. Somebody who is there at the head of a parent, of a family, you know, is leading by example. That is really the most fundamental thing because otherwise, it doesn't compute. If you're saying to everybody, hey, you really need to go to bed super early and watch what you eat, and then they see you binging Netflix box sets until 3 a.m. and bringing in your pizza, you know, I mean, that's not leading, is it? You have to find what you're good at and those skills that you want to communicate. Also, I think just be open and available and really give people a sense that there's a trusted space. Because as I said before, you know, things go wrong. And with the best will in the world, stuff will come up and bite you on the backside that you weren't expecting. And the most important thing is to be straightforward and front it out.
Yeah.
And I would much rather somebody comes to me and said, do you know what? I've made the most awful mistake. This is absolutely catastrophic and I'm so sorry and I really need some help in fixing this. And I've actually thought of a few ways that we could do that. What do you think? So two things there. One is you own up straight away. You don't let it fester. Immediately you sense that something's not right or it's gone wrong or there's an issue. A problem solved is a problem halved. So absolutely, you know, share it with somebody. But then if you are going to somebody for help, you are going to your manager, your team leader, your tutor or whatever, say, actually, this has happened. And here are two or three things I've thought of that will fix it. So you're not just kind of floundering around going, oh, I'm helpless. You know, what do I do? Because that actually doesn't help you grow.
Mm.
And it also doesn't help that you're just going, there, I've just dumped my problem on your lap. You fix it. Taking that next step. And I encourage, you know, my team and my family and my kids, for heaven's sake.
Yeah.
You know, my eldest recently was saying, oh, the washing machine's broken. So it was like, well, did you look at the manual? Oh, I couldn't find the manual. But did you look it up online? Did you make a call to an engineer and find out when the next service appointment is so that we could then discuss whether that's a good option? You know, take that next step in whatever it is, because you then feel empowered.
Mm.
Because when mistakes happen, I think, or bad stuff happens, we can often feel really disempowered and we lose a sense of self and autonomy. But actually thinking it through, I mean, some people say that problems are just opportunities in disguise. I think that's possibly a little bit trite, but, you know, there is something in that, actually. Mm. You can usually solve a problem with some possibly slightly more successful outcome than there was at the beginning.
If we think of our generation that are here today, what would you advise them in terms of the business acumen that you've learned on the way?
Well, my motto has always been build it slow, build it strong. And I think you have to be prepared to crawl and then walk and then run, maybe sprint at the end. But I think today I see this a lot with young people, that there is an impatience and wanting things to happen really fast. Maybe because that's what we're seeing on social media, but actually strong, resilient brands are not built in a flash. You've got to have really solid, strong foundations. And if you are thinking about building a brand, you've got to be absolutely, entirely passionate about it, because it will take up your entire life. You know, you've got to be prepared to put the time in, the money, the effort, the dedication. So if you are not truly, truly passionate about it and absolutely love it beyond all else and think, I'm absolutely not going to be able to live unless I do this thing, then please don't do it, because it will take so much from you. And you have to really genuinely believe and know that it's going to be worth it.
You are the president of the Dame Kelly Holmes Trust,
mm.
which utilises athletes to empower disadvantaged youth and the skills needed to gain real impact.
Yeah.
Can you talk to us about that?
I started Dame Kelly Holmes Trust in 2008, actually. And the reason why I started that charity is because I always remembered my PE teacher, the one person that can make a difference to someone's life. And I wanted to be that person. And so what happened was, I was talking to a lot of athletes that had given up their own, maybe academic careers or careers, let's say, not academic careers, but careers in something where they'd have a job and go to work to be an athlete. And I remember coming back from Athens, winning 2 gold medals and seeing all these other athletes that had no idea what they were going to do next. Yet I'd been put on this pedestal, had all these doors open to me because I had the gold medals. Yet all these other athletes had worked as hard as I had, had, you know, given up everything, been successful, but they didn't have maybe the profile. And in sport, it's like in any world, it's sometimes profile and what door opens to you and what opportunity makes you ahead of somebody else. It doesn't mean you're better than somebody else. It just gives you that stepping stone, right? Anyway, so I thought, as an athlete, what can I do? What skills do we have as athletes, sports people, to help young people? And I believed we have skills that will show that if you don't give up on yourself, you become a better version of yourself. If you have the resilience to get through tough times, you'll go one step further than you ever thought you could. If you can work and communicate effectively with people, you'll get the best out of you because you're asking for support. And that person that you're asking for support is willing to give you more. Because if you ask for support, not always expect it to come straight away, which unfortunately is the world we live in, the doors again open to you. Athletes have gone through the journeys of disbelief, negativity, heartache in some things, injuries, having to give up, told they're not good. We've gone through all of that mentally.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I believe that person had the skills. So what happened was, is because I was also working for lots of other charities for young people. I've done charity work for years.
Yeah.
And I thought, how can I put these two together? And I realised that about empowering people is having one person that can tell you can be good. So I wanted my athletes to be the one person that can tell these young people that felt they couldn't get anywhere in life that they could be good.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I founded that. I had no idea how to start a charity. You know, I started a charity because I had a passion to help others. And as I said, you know, I didn't have any academic skill set, but I had me.
Yep.
And said to this guy once, I need an office space. And I was in London and I'd been on this wonderful trip with a prime minister, with all these business people, really high, high, high business people. And I think, oh God, you know, I'm just this athlete. And then I thought, well, no, I'm Dame Kelly Holmes, the athlete. I was kind of just thinking, well, I just start remembering not to put myself down. I'm with all these business people. And I said to this guy, I need an office. And he said, why? And he was like the CEO of a massive company in the city in London. And I said, because I want to start a charity. And he said, we don't have any offices. I said, you have to have space, like in your big office. I'm not always that confident, even though people see me as a confident person. You do sometimes think, oh, like imposter syndrome, where you feel like you shouldn't be somewhere because other people are better than you. We all get that. Believe me, even me, Dame Kelly Holmes, double Olympic champion, gets imposter syndrome. And I said, you must have room. He said, well, we have a box room. I said, can I have a look at the box room? And I just sort of, at that moment, was so determined that I was going to start this charity. I would take anything. So I went to this big offices. It was literally a box room. I unpiled all the boxes and I went, knocked on his door. I said, I'll take it. So I took it and I had a laptop at the time and I sat on the floor. I didn't have a chair, a table, nothing. I sat on the floor with my laptop and I looked, researched how you start a charity. I already knew I wanted to start with young people. And that was how my charity was born. And we're now 16 years old, or we're going into 16 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
We've helped over 500,000 young people around the country. We transitioned the life of 500 plus athletes into new careers and to become mentors for our young people's programs. And basically, I went from chairing a board. I don't know how to chair a board. I chaired a board of like 12 people for 8 years.
Well done.
Because what I realized is that I know what I want the charity to be. Yeah. I get the people with the skills, because everyone has different skills and we have to remember that we don't always know everything, which I used to think I did until I started this world. And then I thought, well, actually, you know, I need somebody that knows finance. I didn't know finance and numbers. It wasn't good to me. But if I get somebody good, they'll help me.
Yep.
I didn't know about marketing. But if I get somebody good, can help me. And what happened then is I have a team of people around me. I started upskilling myself because I'm listening to them. I'm learning. I know what I want my charity to be. And here we are 16 years later. And that's from not having a clue.
Well, there's some enterprise and entrepreneurial skills coming in there, and business skills, doesn't it? You have to have business skills. And actually, reflecting on that, you don't have to do it all yourself, and bringing in the right people with the right skills at the right time is really important, isn't it?
Yes, it is, really is. And that's the thing. That's what gets you to places. I think for people to get to places is that if you know something that you really want to do, just find out who can help you.
Yeah.
Just ask the right questions.
Yeah.
Because most people that are success. So I think that, unfortunately, for young people in particular, they see people that are successful and think, I can never get there. But what they forget is that person was also at the start of a career as well.
We have some major large employers, but equally important, we have SMEs as well, which there will be a different take on whichever landscape that you're in. So do you have a view on that?
Yeah, I do. Probably about 80% of my work is with education, and I do probably about 20% is with businesses, large and SMEs. I think a great way for businesses to get into this is marketing. It's probably one of the first use cases for this technology because it can be quite good at writing. So any copy that companies need in terms of emails, newsletters, website writing, social media writing, whatever it is, using these tools can help give some great ideas. In fact, I know of a few very small businesses with just a few employees who would seriously thinking about hiring a marketing person.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think this fully replaces somebody who's good at marketing. However, just with a bit of knowledge on how to use some of these tools, they're able to create, in just a few minutes really, a week's worth of content that they may send out to customers or prospective customers. So I think that's a nice place to start. Well, what we're starting to see as well is from other businesses around the world is them starting to use AI to interact with customers directly. So probably the best example at the minute is the finance company Klarna. And what they did was they designed an AI that would speak to their customers, and they've had massive, massive impact. I think there was a newspaper report out at the end of February that said that their AI was doing the work of about 700 agents. It was getting 25% less repeat inquiries because the AI was very accurate with the information it was given to customers. There are lots of different avenues businesses can start to look at with this technology in terms of customer relations, marketing. Also, though, and one that doesn't get mentioned all that often is some of these tools are really good at taking a lot of information and holding that information and analysing it really well.
Yeah.
So we're starting to see, although they might not admit it very readily, but leaders of companies starting to use it to assist decision making. And because as a human, we can only hold so much information in our heads when we make those decisions. But if you train an AI on the data you need it to know to make a decision and then ask it for its insights, you can use that. Again, that's not going to replace a good CEO or a good leader, because as you will know, as one of these good leaders, is that a lot of it is experience and intuition as well. So it's not going to fully replace that, but as an extra source of evidence to help make decisions, I think some of these AIs are really coming into their own. And again, we're scratching the surface here. I think with the capabilities and some of the capability that's being worked on at the moment behind the scenes by the AI companies, so we're going to see more and more use cases. About a year ago, I noticed there was a website out there where you could, instead of getting a new employee, you could subscribe to an employee. So if you wanted someone to do your finance, you could subscribe and you would have an AI finance person doing that for you. Now, that opens up a whole lot of other questions about placement versus augmentation.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of the evidence is suggesting that it's the collaboration between humans and AI that is getting the better results, not just the AI on its own.
Skillfully Speaking is supported by Babcock International. Visit babcockinternational.com. Presented by Jackie Grubb. Produced by Paul Philpott. Production support by Lisa Hartwell. Edited and mixed by Martin Burgess Moon. Video content by Mark Stevenson. Coordinated by Louise Greenleaf. Produced by Fresh Air Studios. Copyright City College Plymouth, all rights reserved.